The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, concluded. Cassette 15, Side 2. This is how it's done. On the pretense that their identity must be checked, the Baptists who arrived to attend the trial were held in jail for 3 days, until the trial was over, and to give them a fright. Someone, a free citizen, who threw flowers to the defendants, got 10 days. So did a Baptist who kept a record of the trial, and his notes were taken away. But another record survived. A bunch of hand-picked komsomols were let in before the general public by a side door, so that they could occupy the front rows. While the trial was in progress, there were shouts from the spectators. Pour kerosene over the lot and set fire to them. The court did nothing to curb this righteous indignation. Typical of its procedures, it admitted the evidence of hostile neighbours and also that of terrorised minors. Little girls of 9 and 11 were brought before the court. Who the hell cares what effect it has on them as long as we get our verdict? Their exercise books with texts from the scriptures were introduced as exhibits. One of the defendants, Bazbei, father of 9 children, was a minor, who had never received any support from the Union Committee at his pit because he was a Baptist. But they managed to confuse his daughter Nina, a schoolgirl in the 8th grade, and to suborn her with 50 rubles from the Union Committee, and a promise to place her in an institute later on, so that during the investigation she made fantastic statements against her father. He had tried to poison her with a sour fruit drink. When the believers were hiding in the woods for their prayer meeting, because they were persecuted in the settlement, they had had a radio transmitter, a tall tree with wire wound all around it. Afterward, these lying statements began to prey on Nina's mind. She became mentally ill and was put in the violent ward of an asylum. Nonetheless, she was produced in court in the expectation that she would stick to her evidence, but she repudiated every word of it. The interrogator dictated what I had to say himself. It made no difference. The shameless judge ignored her latest statements and regarded only her earlier evidence as valid. Whenever depositions favourable to the prosecution came unstuck, this is the typical and regular dodge used by the courts. They ignore what is brought out in court and base themselves on faked evidence obtained in the preliminary investigation. Now, what do you mean by that? It says here in your deposition, you testified during the investigation. What right have you to retract now? That's an offence too, you know. The judge is not at all interested in the substance of the case. In the truth, the Baptists are persecuted because they do not accept preachers sent by an atheist plenipotentiary of the state, but prefer their own. Under Baptist rules, any brother can preach the gospel. There is a directive from the Oblast Party Committee. Put them on trial and forcibly take their children from them. And this will be carried out, although with its left hand the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet has just, July 2, 1962, signed the World Convention on the Fight Against Discrimination in the Sphere of Education. But, of course, we signed it for the sake of the American Negroes. How else could it concern us? One of its points is that parents must be allowed to provide for the religious and moral education of their children in accordance with their own convictions. But that is precisely what we cannot allow. Anyone who speaks in court on the substance of the case, anyone who tries to clarify the issue, is invariably interrupted, diverted from his train of thought, deliberately confused by the judge who conducts the debate on this level. How can you talk about the end of the world when we are committed to the building of communism? This is from the closing statement made by one young girl, Zhenya Kloponina. Instead of going to the cinema or to dances, I used to read the Bible and say my prayers, and just for that you are taking my freedom from me? Yes, to be free is a great happiness, but to be free from sin is a greater still. Lenin said that only in Turkey and Russia did such shameful phenomena as religious persecution still exist. I've never been in Turkey and know nothing about it, but how things are in Russia you can see for yourselves. She was cut short. The sentences? 2 of them got 5 years in the camps, 2 of them 4 years, and Bazbei, father of all those children, got 3. The defendants accepted their sentences joyfully and said a prayer. The representatives from Enterprises shouted, "Not long enough! Make it more! Throw kerosene over them and put a match to it." The long-suffering Baptists took note and kept count, and set up a council of prisoners' relatives, which began issuing manuscript bulletins about all the persecutions. From these bulletins we learn that from 1961 to June 1964, 197 Baptists were condemned, 15 of them women. One of the trials of populists 100 years ago was called the Trial of the 193. Lord, what a fuss there was! What emotions were stirred! It even found its way into the textbooks. They're all listed by name. Prisoners' dependents, now left without means of support, have also been counted. 442, of whom 341 are under school age. The majority get 5 years of exile, but some get 5 years in a strict regime camp, narrowly escaping the hardened criminals' motley, with 3 to 5 years of exile in addition. B.M. Zdorovets from Orshany in Kharkov Oblast got 7 years of strict regime for his faith. A 76-year-old, Y.V. Arend, was put inside, as were the whole Lodzovoy family, father, mother, and son. Yevgeny M. Sirokin, a Group 1 disabled veteran of the Fatherland War, blind in both eyes, was condemned in the village of Sokolovo, Zmievsky district, Kharkov Oblast, to 3 years in a camp for bringing up his children Lyuba, Nadia, and Raya as Christians, and they were taken away from him by order of the court. The court trying the Baptist M.I. Brodovsky at Nikolaev, October 6, 1966, was not too squeamish to use crudely faked documents. When the defendant protested, "This is dishonest of you," they barked back at him, "The law will crush you, smash you, destroy you." The law, my friend. Not one of your acts of extrajudicial vengeance, as practiced in the years when norms were still observed. We recently got to know S. Karavansky's soul-chilling petition, which was transmitted from a camp to the outside world. The author had been sentenced to 25 years, had served 16 of them, 1944 to 1960, had been released, evidently under the two-thirds rule, had married, had begun a university course, but no, in 1965 they came for him again. Get yourself ready, you still have 9 years to go. Where else is this possible? Under what other code of law on earth except ours? They had hung quarters around people's necks like iron collars, sentences which would end sometime in the 70s. Suddenly a new code is promulgated, 1961, with no sentence higher than 15 years. Even a first-year law student can see that those 25-year sentences are thereby rescinded. Only we do not agree that they are. Yell yourself hoarse, beat your head on the wall if you like. They are not rescinded. We feel rather that you should step back inside and finish your time. There are quite a few people like this, people who were not affected by the epidemic of releases under Khrushchev, the teammates, cellmates, transit prison acquaintances whom we left behind. We have long ago forgotten them in our new lives, but they still shuffle hopelessly, drearily, numbly about the same little patches of trampled earth, with the same watchtowers and barbed wire fences all around them. The faces in the papers change, the speeches from platforms change. People fight against the cult and then stop fighting. But the 25-year prisoners, Stalin's godchildren, are still inside. Karavansky cites the blood-freezing prison careers of several such people. All you freedom-loving left-wing thinkers in the West, you left laborites, you progressive American, German, and French students. As far as you are concerned, none of this amounts to much. As far as you are concerned, this whole book of mine is a waste of effort. You may suddenly understand it all some day, but only when you yourselves hear, "Hands behind your backs there," and step ashore on our archipelago. Still, there really is no comparison between the numbers of political prisoners now and in Stalin's time. They are no longer counted in millions or in hundreds of thousands. Is this because the law has been reformed? No, it is just that the ship has changed course for a time. Courtroom epidemics flare up just as they used to, lightening the labours of the legal brain. Even the newspapers will keep you abreast if you know how to read them. When they start writing about hooligans, you know that the courts are jailing people wholesale on charges of hooliganism. If they write about theft from the state, you know that the fashionable charge is embezzlement. Zex, writing from today's colonies, tell us despondently that it is useless trying to find justice. What you read in the press is one thing, real life is another. V.I.D. I'm sick of being an outcast from my society and my people, but where can I get justice? The interrogator's word carries more weight than mine. Yet what knowledge or insight can she, a young girl of 23, have? How can she possibly imagine the fate they can send a man to? V.K. The reason they never reopen cases is that if they did, some of them might become redundant. L. Blank N. Stalinist methods of investigation and trial have simply migrated from the political to the criminal sphere, and that's all there is to it. G.S. Let us note carefully what these suffering people have told us. One, retrial is impossible, because the judicial caste might collapse. Two, nowadays they use the criminal clauses to make mincemeat of people, just as they once used Article 58. If they did not, what would they feed on, and what would become of the archipelago? Briefly, suppose one citizen wishes to rid the world of another whom he dislikes, not, of course, straightforwardly with a knife between the ribs, but legally. What is the surest way of doing it? Formerly, he would have had to write a denunciation under Article 58.10, but now he should begin by consulting the professionals, investigating officers, policemen, court officials. That sort of citizen always has friends of this sort. To find what is in fashion this year, for what type of offender are the nets being laid, in which category are the courts required to increase their yield? Find the appropriate clause and stick that in him. It's as good as any knife. Thus, a storm of accusations under the rape clause raged for a long time after Nikita, in a heated moment, ordered minimum sentences of 12 years. Thousands of hammers in every locality began busily riveting on 12-year fetters, for the smiths must never stand idle. Now, this clause deals with delicate and very private matters. Weigh it carefully, and you will see that in some ways it resembles Article 58.10. The offences covered by each are committed tête-à-tête. They are difficult to verify. They are shy of witnesses. And that is just what the courts require. Take the S. Blank V. case. Two Leningrad women were summoned to the police station. Had they been at a party with some men? Yes. Had sexual intercourse taken place? This had already been established with the aid of a reliable informer. Yes. Right, then. Which is it? Did you take part in the sexual act voluntarily or against your will? If voluntary, we shall have to regard you as prostitutes. You will hand over your passports and get out of Leningrad in 48 hours. If it was against your will, you must bring a charge of rape. The women were not a bit anxious to leave Leningrad, so the men got 12 years each. Our obtuse, our blinkered, our hulking brute of a judicial system can live only if it is infallible. The brute is so strong and so sure of itself only because it never reconsiders its decisions, because every officer of the court can lay about him as he pleases in the certainty that no one will ever correct him. To this end, there exists a tacit understanding that every complaint, whatever summit of summits you send it to, will be referred back to the very authority of which you are complaining. Let no officer of the court, prosecutor or investigator, be censured for abusing his office, for giving free rein to bad temper or a desire for personal vengeance, for making a mistake or for misconducting a case. We will cover up for him, protect him, form a wall around him. We are the law, and that is what law is for. What is the good of beginning an investigation and then not bringing charges? Does this not mean that the interrogator's work is wasted? What is the good of a hearing without a conviction? Wouldn't the People's Court be letting the investigating officer down and wasting his time? What does it mean when an oblast court overturns the decision of a People's Court? It means that the higher court has added another botched job to the Oblast's record. Think of the discomfort you would be causing your comrades in the profession. What's the point of it? Once begun, as the result of a denunciation, let's say, an investigation must end without fail in a conviction which cannot possibly be quashed. Above all, don't let one another down, and don't let the RICOM down. Do what they tell you. In return, they will see that you come to no harm. Another very important thing about the courts today, there is no tape recorder, no stenographer, just a thick-fingered secretary with the leisurely penmanship of an 18th-century schoolgirl, laboriously recording some part of the proceedings in the transcript. This record is not read out during the session, and no one is allowed to see it until the judge has looked it over and approved it. Only what the judge confirms will remain on record, will have happened in court, while things that we have heard with our own ears vanish like smoke. They never happened at all. In his mind's eye, the judge can always see the shiny black visage of truth, the telephone in his chambers. This oracle will never fail you as long as you do what it says. Endure and flourish, O noble company of judges. We exist for you, not you for us. May justice be a thick piled carpet beneath your feet. If it goes well with you, then all is well. The proven reliability of the judicial system makes the lives of the police much easier. It enables them to apply without misgiving the method known as the trailer or the crime sack. Because of the slackness, the inefficiency, the boneheadedness of the local police, crime after crime after crime remains unsolved. But to keep the books straight, criminals must be exposed and cases closed. So they wait for a suitable opportunity. A man lands in the police station, somebody pliant, easily bullied, not too bright, and they saddle him with all these unsolved crimes. He's the one, all this year, the elusive master criminal. Pummel and starve him till he confesses everything, puts his name to it all, earns himself a sentence commensurate with the grand total of his crimes, and so wipe a blot from the district. The health of society is much improved, since no sin goes unpunished, and the police in charge of criminal investigations are given prizes. The health of society has improved still further, and justice has been further reinforced in recent years, since the cry went up that parasites should be seized, tried, and deported. This decree was also a partial replacement for the elastic 5810, now only a memory. Accusations made under it proved just as insidious, just as flimsy, and just as irrefutable. They managed to use it against I. Brodsky, the poet. The meaning of the word was skillfully distorted from the start. Real parasites, highly paid drones, sat on the bench or at their bureaucratic desks while sentences rained down on paupers with skills and an appetite for work who knocked themselves out trying to earn a bit extra when the working day was over. How viciously, with the undying hatred of the overfed for the hungry, they fell upon these idlers. Two of Ajoubet's unscrupulous journalists had the effrontery to declare that parasites were not being banished far enough from Moscow. They were allowed to receive parcels and money orders from relatives. Discipline was not strict enough. They are not made to work from dawn to dusk. These are their very words, from dawn to dusk. What communist dawn, what constitutional order, we may wonder, can call for such drudgery? We have listed several important streams, which, together with the endless spate of embezzlers, ensure that the archipelago is continually replenished. Nor is it altogether wasted effort for the People's Brigades, Druzhiniki, those freebooters or storm troopers commissioned by the militia, unmentioned in the Constitution, and free from responsibility before the law, to walk the streets or stay comfortably in their command posts, knocking out the teeth of prisoners. Reinforcements flow into the archipelago, and although we have had a classless society for so long, although the glow of the communist conflagration half fills the sky, we are used to the idea that crime never ceases, never decreases, and indeed that no one now seems to promise any such thing. In the 1930s, they assured us, "We're almost there, just a few more years." They don't even make such statements anymore. The law in our country, in its might and its flexibility, is unlike anything called law elsewhere on earth. The stupid Romans had a formula. The law has no retroactive force. With us, it has. An old reactionary proverb may mutter, laws aren't written for what's gone and done. In our country, they are. If a modish new decree comes out and the law itches to apply it to persons already in custody, why not let it do so? This is what happened to the currency speculators and bribe takers. Lists were sent from, say, Kiev to Moscow, where the names of those to whom the law could be retrospectively applied were ticked off, and they were given a longer stretch or promoted to 9 grams of lead accordingly. Then again, in our country, the law is clairvoyant. You might suppose that before a trial takes place, the course of the hearing and the verdict would be unknown. But you may find socialist legality publishing all this before the trial takes place. How can it know? Just ask yourself. See the organ of the Public Prosecutor's Office of the USSR, number 1, January 1962, signed for the press on December the 27th, 1961. On pages 73 to 74, there is an article by Grigoriev Gruzda called Fascist Hangmen. It contains a report on the trial of some Estonian war criminals at Tartu. The writer describes the questioning of witnesses, the exhibits before the court, the cross-examination of one defendant. The murderer cynically answered. The reactions of the public, the prosecutor's speech. It further reports that sentence of death was passed. All these things, indeed, occurred exactly as described, but not till January the 16th, 1962. See Pravda for January the 17th, by which time the journal was already in print and on sale. The trial had been postponed and the journal had not been warned. The journalist concerned got 1 year's forced labour. Then again, Soviet law has forgotten all about the sin of bearing false witness and simply does not regard it as a crime. A legion of false witnesses thrives in our midst. They go sedately on their way to an honourable old age, bask in a golden sunset at the end of their days. Ours is the only country in the world and in history to pamper perjurers. Then again, Soviet law does not punish murdering judges and murdering prosecutors. They all enjoy long and honourable careers and live to be noble elders. Then again, no one can deny that Soviet law is capable of those abrupt changes of course, those sudden swerves characteristic of all anxious creative thought. At times, the law veers toward sharp reduction of crime in a single year. Arrest fewer, try fewer, release convicted offenders on probation. At other times, it veers in the opposite direction. Evildoers endlessly multiply. No more probation, send more to hard labor and special regime camps. Stiffer sentences, execute the villains. Whatever storms may buffet it, the vessel of the law sails smoothly and majestically on. Our supreme courts, our supreme prosecutors, our old hands, and no gust will take them by surprise. They will conduct their plenary sessions. They will issue their instructions. And every insane change of course will be shown to be a long-felt need, a logical result of our whole historic development, prophetically envisaged in the one true doctrine. The vessel of Soviet law is ready for the sharpest turn. If orders come tomorrow to put millions inside again for their way of thinking, or to deport whole peoples, the same peoples as before or others, or rebellious towns, or to pin 4 numbers on prisoners again, its mighty hull will scarcely tremble, its stem will not buckle. There remains what Dershavin tells us, what only those who have experienced it for themselves can feel in their hearts. An unjust court is worse than brigandage. Yes, that remains true, as true as it was under Stalin, as it was all through the years described in this book. Many fundamental principles, decrees, and laws, contradictory or complementary, have been promulgated and printed. But it is not in accordance with them that our country lives and that arrests are made, trials held, expert evidence given. Only in those few cases, 15% perhaps, in which the subject of investigation and judicial proceedings affects neither the interests of the state, nor the reigning ideology, nor the personal interests or comfort of some office-holder? Only very rarely can the officers of the court enjoy the privilege of trying a case without telephoning somebody to seek instructions, of trying it on its merits and as conscience dictates. All other cases, the overwhelming majority, criminal or civil, it makes no difference, inevitably affect in some important way the interests of the chairman of a kolkhoz or a village soviet, a shop foreman, a factory manager, the head of a housing bureau, a block sergeant, the investigating officer or commander of a police district, the medical superintendent of a hospital, a chief planning officer, the heads of administrations or ministries, special sections or personnel sections, the secretaries of district or oblast party committees, and upward, ever upward. In all such cases, calls are made from one discreet inner office to another. Leisurely, lowered voices give friendly advice, steady and steer the decision to be reached in the trial of a wretched little man caught in the tangled schemes, which he would not understand even if he knew them, of those set in authority over him. The naively trusting little newspaper reader goes into the courtroom conscious that he is in the right. His reasonable arguments are carefully rehearsed, and he lays them before the somnolent mask-like faces on the bench, never suspecting that sentence has been passed on him already, that there are no courts of appeal, no proper channels and due procedures through which a malignant, a corrupt, a soul-searingly unjust verdict can be undone. There is only a war, and its bricks are laid in a mortar of lies. We call this chapter The Law Today. It should rightly be called There Is No Law. The same treacherous secrecy, the same fog of injustice, still hangs in our air, worse than the smoke of city chimneys. For half a century and more, the enormous state has towered over us, girded with hoops of steel. The hoops are still there. There is no law. Afterward. Instead of my writing this book alone, the chapters should have been shared among people with special knowledge, and we should then have met in editorial conference and helped each other to put the whole in true perspective. But the time for this was not yet. Those whom I asked to take on particular chapters would not do so, but instead offered stories, written or oral, for me to use as I pleased. I suggested to Varlam Shalamov that we write the whole book together, but he also declined. What was really needed was a well-staffed office, to advertise in the newspapers and on the radio, please reply, to carry on open correspondence, to do what was done with the story of the Brest Fortress. Not only could I not spread myself like this, I had to conceal the project itself, my letters, my materials, to disperse them, to do everything in deepest secrecy. I even had to camouflage the time I spent working on the book with what looked like work on other things. As soon as I began the book, I thought of abandoning it. I could not make up my mind, should I or should I not be writing such a book by myself, and would I have the stamina for it? But when, in addition to what I had collected, prisoners' letters converged on me from all over the country, I realized that since all this had been given to me, I had a duty. I must explain that never once did this whole book, in all its parts, lie on the same desk at the same time. In September 1965, when work on the archipelago was at its most intensive, I suffered a setback. My archive was raided and my novel impounded. At this point, the parts of the archipelago already written and the materials for the other parts were scattered and never reassembled. I could not take the risk, especially when all the names were given correctly. I kept jotting down reminders to myself to check this and remove that, and traveled from place to place with these bits of paper. The jerkiness of the book, its imperfections, are the true mark of our persecuted literature. Take the book for what it is. I have stopped work on the book not because I regard it as finished, but because I cannot spend any more of my life on it. Besides begging for indulgence, I want to cry aloud, when the time and the opportunity come, gather together all you friends who have survived and know the story well, write your own commentaries to go with my book, correct and add to it where necessary, but do not make it too unwieldy, do not duplicate what is there already. Only then will the book be definitive. God bless the work. I am surprised to have finished it safely, even in this form. I have several times thought they would not let me. I am finishing it in the year of a double anniversary, and the two anniversaries are connected. It is 50 years since the revolution which created Gulag, and 100 since the invention of barbed wire, 1867. This second anniversary will no doubt pass unnoticed. Ryazan, Ukrivishche, April 27, 1958, to February 22, 1967. P.P.S. I was in a hurry when I wrote what you have just read, because I expected that even if I did not perish in the explosion set off by my letter to the Writers' Congress, I should lose my freedom to write and access to my manuscripts. But as things turned out, I was not only not arrested as a result of the letter, but found myself on a granite footing. I realized then that I must and could complete and correct this book. A few friends have now read it. They have helped me to see the serious defects in it. I did not try it out on a wider circle, and if this ever becomes possible, it will be too late for me. In this last year, I have done what I could to improve it. Let no one blame me for its incompleteness. There is no end to the additions which could be made, and every single person who has had the slightest contact with the subject, or thought seriously about it, will always be able to add something, often something precious. But there are laws of proportion. In size, my book has reached the utmost limit. Push in a few more little grains, and the whole cliff will come tumbling down. For sometimes expressing myself badly, for repetition in places and loose construction in others, I ask forgiveness. I was not granted a quiet year, after all, and during the last few months the ground has been burning under my feet again, and the desk under my hand. Even while preparing this last version, I have never once seen the whole book together, never once had it all on my desk at one time. The full list of those without whom this book could not have been written, revised, or kept safe, cannot yet be entrusted to paper. They know who they are. They have my homage. Rojdestvo na Ista, May 1968. This concludes the reading of The Gulag Archipelago. This book was read by Frederick Davidson. If you would like to receive a free catalogue listing our complete line of audiobooks, write us at Post Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call toll-free 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Will you please wind or rewind the tape as appropriate, so as to present the book in order for the next person to enjoy? Thank you.